Before we even jump in today, this deep dive is brought to you by Cert Fuel.
Oh, yeah, they're great.
Yeah, I mean, if you're studying for the Series 3 right now, they've got this full course. It has adaptive quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams that are weighted, exactly like the real thing.
Which is huge, honestly.
Right. So check them out at certfuel.com. Anyway, all right, let's get into it.
Let's do it.
So usually when we talk about like a medical diagnosis, there's this expectation of absolute precision.
Right, like engineering.
Exactly. You fall, you break your arm, the x-ray shows that jagged white line on the film, and the doctor just points to it and says, "There it is. That's the problem."
It's binary, clean.
Very comforting because, we like things to be visible and perfectly categorized. But then you step into the world of futures markets and physical delivery, and suddenly that x-ray machine is just, it's totally broken.
Oh, completely smashed to pieces.
Right. You look at your brokerage account, the screen shows a simple glowing green number saying you own a week contract, and you think, great, I made a profit.
But if you don't understand the complex legal reality that green number actually represents,
Which a lot of people don't.
right, you might wake up next Tuesday to find, I don't know, 5,000 bushels of literal physical raw wheat being dumped into the lobby of your apartment building.
Which is just honestly terrifying if you don't know the rules.
It is the absolute definition of a logistical minefield because that green number on your screen isn't just a stock ticker.
Right. It's not just some abstract math.
Exactly. It is a binding legal contract compelling you to take delivery of a physical commodity under very specific, highly regulated conditions.
And for anyone taking the Series 3 exam, which is what we're focused on today, this isn't just trivia.
No, this is the entire core of the test.
Right. Our mission for this deep dive is mastering offsetting contracts, settlements, and delivery. And if you are prepping for the Series 3 right now, yeah, you need to hear this loud and clear.
It's a massive chunk of the exam.
We are talking about spanning roughly 71% across chapters 1 through 7 combined.
Yeah, it's the lifeblood of the regulatory framework. You absolutely cannot guess your way through this.
You really can't. You need to deeply learn the mechanics, retain them, and apply them to scenarios you've never even seen before.
And that's why we are going to focus intensely on why these mechanics exist, you know, not just what the rules are.
Which is so important for actually retaining the info.
Exactly. Because when you understand the underlying why, the rationale behind the regulation, you don't have to memorize 100 isolated
You
flashcards.
just follow the logic of the market.
Spot on. And the golden rule, the fundamental thesis of this entire unit, and frankly, the entire futures market, is this: the direction you trade dictates your fate.
Okay, wait, let's unpack that immediately. The direction you trade. What do we mean by direction? Like, are we talking about bullish versus bearish?
Not exactly. We're talking about whether you are the buyer or the seller of the contract. In the futures market, all traders are not created equal when it comes to expiration. The
The
short,
feller, right.
right, the short is the one in the driver's seat. They control the delivery process.
And the long.
The long, the buyer, is simply the passive party sitting in the passenger seat, basically just praying they don't get accidentally crushed by a mountain of physical commodities.
I love that visual, and I want to make sure it really sticks for you, the listener, because it's going to govern everything we talk about today.
It really is the key to all of this.
So to do that, we're going to introduce a cast of characters that we will follow throughout this entire deep dive. Because honestly, having real people in these scenarios makes it feel like a story rather than, just reading a dry textbook.
Yeah, it helps so much. So, character number one, Farmer Fred.
Good old Farmer Fred.
Farmer Fred is our short. He is the seller. Fred is out there in his denim overalls, actually growing the physical wheat.
Right. He has the actual goods sitting in a massive corrugated steel silo on his property out in Kansas.
Exactly. And because he actually possesses the physical commodity, the exchange gives him the power. He holds all the cards.
So he calls the shots on how and when delivery happens.
He absolutely does.
Okay, so on the other side of the trade, we have character number two, Speculator Sally.
Right. Sally is our long. She is the buyer.
And Sally does not own overalls.
Definitely not.
She's never driven a tractor. Sally lives in this chic fifth floor walk-up apartment in downtown Chicago.
She trades futures on her smartphone while drinking an oat milk latte, right?
Exactly. She bought a contract because she's betting on the global price of wheat going up. But she is absolutely fundamentally terrified of accidentally receiving 5,000 bushels of raw grain in her tiny apartment lobby.
She is the ultimate passive party. If Sally isn't incredibly careful with her account management, Fred is going to back a diesel dump truck right up to her building.
Right. So keeping Fred and his dump truck and Sally and her latte in mind, let's figure out how Sally actually gets out of this situation.
Because she definitely wants out.
Right. She doesn't want the wheat. And the fascinating reality of this market is that the vast, vast majority of futures contracts never actually reach that loading dock.
That's a crucial starting point for the exam. Historically, something like 98% of all futures contracts are closed out before physical delivery ever happens.
98%? That's huge.
It is. I mean, speculator Sally wants cash profits. She does not want grain. She has no use for the physical commodity whatsoever.
And honestly, Farmer Fred usually just wants to lock in a price, right? Just to protect his profit margin on paper.
Exactly. When harvest time comes, he might actually just sell his real physical wheat to a local commercial bakery down the street. It's way easier than going through the massive logistical headache of a formal exchange delivery.
So they both want out before the clock runs out. But how does Sally actually execute that exit?
This brings us to the core mechanical concept of liquidating. Offsetting.
Offsetting. Okay, let's break that down.
Offsetting is the standard everyday exit door in the futures market. To offset, which, by the way, is also called liquidating a position, a trader must execute an equal and opposite transaction.
Equal and opposite.
Right. But it comes with a very strict, non-negotiable condition. It must be in the exact same commodity, the exact same delivery month, and on the exact same exchange.
It has to be a perfectly identical match.
Exactly.
I like to think of this like matter meeting antimatter in quantum physics. You know, you have a particle of matter that's your open contract.
Okay, I like where this is going.
Right, so to make it vanish from the universe, you can't just throw any random antimatter at it. You have to throw the exact corresponding antiparticle.
And when they touch,
boom, they annihilate each other, leaving nothing behind but the realized cash profit or loss in your brokerage account.
That is the exact logic the exchange's matching engine uses. It is constantly scanning for that perfect identical annihilation.
But let's test that, because I feel like this is where people mess up. Let's say speculator Sally bought one contract of December Chicago wheat. She is long.
Okay.
She has a profit, and she wants to offset today. But she's rushing, she opens her app, and she accidentally sells one contract of March Chicago wheat.
Oh, boy.
Does the matching engine annihilate her position? I mean, she bought December, but she sold March. It's still wheat. It's still Chicago. Is that close enough?
It is not even close to enough. It absolutely does not cancel out. That is not an offset.
Really? Just because of the month?
Just because of the month. Because she chose a different delivery month, the exchange does not see an equal and opposite trade.
So what happens to her account?
Instead of closing her existing position, Sally just created a brand new one. Yeah. She is now legally long December wheat And she is legally short March wheat.
Oh, wow. So she didn't close a door. She opened a second door.
Precisely. She just established what is called a spread position. She now has two open contracts with the exchange.
Which means she needs margin for both.
Yeah. She has to post margin for both legs of the spread, and she has completely failed to eliminate her delivery risk for December.
The match must be exact. Same commodity, same month, same exchange.
Do not forget that on the exam.
Okay. That makes total sense mechanically. But now, let's talk about the direction of this trade, because this leads us straight into a massive conceptual trap that catches a lot of test takers.
Oh, yeah, the exit direction.
Right. You must reverse your entry to exit. It sounds so incredibly simple, but under the pressure of a timed, high-stakes regulatory exam, your brain can completely misfire on the vocabulary here.
It happens all the time. Let's look at speculator Sally. She is long. She opened her position by buying the contract.
Okay.
To offset and get out, she must do the exact opposite. She must sell an identical contract.
Brought to open, sell to close. That part usually feels pretty intuitive for people.
But now look at Farmer Fred. He is short. He opened his position by selling the contract.
Right.
So to offset, he must BUY it back.
And here is where the exam will test your composure, right?
Mm.
Regulators are testing if you understand the legal distinction between adding to a position versus liquidating one.
Exactly. They will use tricky, specific phrasing to see if you actually understand the direction of flow.
Give me an example of how they'd ask it.
Okay, the exam might give you a scenario like, a trader went short 5 live cattle contracts in April. In May, to liquidate the position, the trader should. And one of the perfectly reasonable sounding wrong answers will be sell to close.
And your panicked brain sees the word close paired with sell and thinks, I sell things when I want to get rid of them.
Yes, but no, you have to stop and trace the logic.
Right, because if you got in by selling, you cannot get out by selling more. You are just doubling your short position.
Exactly. If you are short, you must buy to offset. If you are long, you must sell to offset.
Okay, I'm going to pause the conversation right now. I'm speaking directly to you, the listener.
Pay attention.
Let's test this in real time. Imagine you just shorted a live cattle contract because you did your research and you think beef prices are dropping. You are the seller.
Okay, you are short.
You've held it for a week, prices dropped, you've made a great profit, and you want out today. What is the exact physical action you take in your brokerage account to close that position?
Take a second.
Think about it. You started by shorting.
You buy it back.
Right. If you said sell to close, you just add another short contract to your portfolio and the exam just docked you points.
The exit is always the reverse of the entry. Lock that fundamental truth into your brain right now.
Awesome. So we've established how individual traders get the heck out of the market. Sally sells, Fred buys.
Yep.
But how does all this individual buying and selling affect the big picture? When Sally taps sell on her phone, what actually happens to the overall market data?
Ah, this takes us to the concept of open interest.
And this is an area where people routinely lose points because they confuse it with volume.
Open interest is widely misunderstood. People conflate it with trading volume all the time, but they are entirely different metrics measuring entirely different things.
So, how do you define volume?
Volume is just a running body count of how many transactions happen today. If I buy a contract and sell it 5 seconds later and do that 10 times a day, I've created 20 units of volume.
But at the end of the day, your net position is zero.
Exactly. Volume resets to zero every single morning. Open interest, on the other hand, is a running continuous tally.
Okay, a continuous tally of what?
It is the total number of futures contracts that have been entered into but have not yet been offset or fulfilled by physical delivery.
So it's literally the number of contracts that are currently alive out there in the world.
Exactly. For every single contract that exists, there is one buyer and one seller. Together, they make one unit of open interest.
And the exam loves to test your understanding of how open interest fluctuates, right?
Oh, they love it because it doesn't just automatically go up when people trade. It can go up, it can go down, or it can stay exactly the same.
Depending on what?
Depending entirely on the specific status of the two parties participating in the trade. Are they opening a new position or closing an old one?
Okay, let's break this down into scenarios. We are going to do a side-by-side comparison so you can see exactly how the math works.
Good idea. Let's walk through a hypothetical trading week.
Scenario one, open interest rises. How does a brand new contract get born?
Open interest rises when a brand new buyer and a brand new seller enter the market at the exact same time.
So let's introduce two new characters for this. It's Monday morning. Newbie Ned wants to go long week today. He has no existing position. He clicks buy.
Right, and at the exact same time, fresh Fiona wants to go short wheat. She also has no existing position. She clicks sell.
So the exchange's matching engine pairs Ned's buy order with Fiona's sell order.
Exactly. Because neither of them were in the market before this moment, a brand new contract is birthed into existence.
So open interest goes up by one, and volume for the day is one.
Spot on.
Simple enough. Two new people. One new contract. Now, scenario two, open interest falls. How do we kill a contract?
Open interest falls when an existing long and an existing short both offset against each other.
Okay, it's Tuesday. Let's bring back our original characters. Speculator Sally is an existing long. She bought a wheat contract a month ago.
And Farmer Fred is an existing short. He sold a wheat contract a month ago.
Today, they both decide they want out. Sally hits sell to offset her long. At the exact same microsecond, Fred hits buy to offset his short.
The exchange matching engine pairs Sally's sell order with Fred's buy order.
This is the matter meeting antimatter we talked about.
Exactly, because both of them were actively closing existing open positions, that single contract they traded against each other is completely extinguished. It vanishes from the universe.
And therefore, the total open interest of the market goes down by one.
Yes.
Okay, so if two new people open, it goes up. If two existing people close, it goes down. That is perfectly logical.
But here is where the exam sets the trap.
Scenario three. Open interest is unchanged. How on earth can a transaction occur, generating volume, but the open interest number doesn't move a single inch?
This happens when an existing trader offsets their position to a brand new trader who is just entering the market.
Okay, it's Wednesday. Walk me through it.
Let's go back to Speculator Sally. She is an existing long holding her wheat contract. She wants out. She clicks sell to offset.
But this time, Farmer Fred isn't there to buy it back.
Right. Instead, her sell order gets matched with newbie Ned.
And remember, Ned is brand new today. He has no position, and he wants to buy to open a new long position.
Exactly. So I want to make sure the mechanics of this are crystal clear. Sally is executing a sell to close. Ned is executing a buy to open.
So what happens to the contract itself?
It doesn't vanish because Ned just bought it to open his position.
Yeah.
And a new one isn't birthed because Sally just gave hers up.
It just changes hands.
Exactly. The contract simply changes hands. Sally steps out of the long position, takes her cash, and leaves. Ned steps into the exact same long position and assumes the risk.
And Farmer Fred is still sitting out there on the short side of this contract, completely unaware that his counterparty just legally swapped from Sally to Ned.
He has no idea, and he doesn't need to know. Because the contract merely transferred ownership, the total number of alive contracts remains exactly the same.
So volume goes up by one for the day, but open interest is completely unchanged.
Spot on. And here is the trap. The regulators will give you a question that says, Trader A liquidates his long position by selling one contract. What happens to open interest?
Oh, I see it. And you must recognize that you cannot answer that question with the information provided.
Exactly. A single offsetting trade does not automatically shrink open interest. It only falls if both sides of the transaction are closing.
If the person on the other side is a new trader, opening a position, open interest stays flat.
You have to know the specific intent of both the buyer and the seller to know what happens to the open interest metric.
That is such a critical distinction.
Right.
And it matters because regulators watch open interest like a hawk.
They absolutely do. If open interest is massive, it means there is a ton of capital at risk, which means higher potential for systemic volatility if prices swing wildly.
Open interest tells you the weight of the market. Volume just tells you the speed.
That's a great way to put it.
Okay, wait, time out.
Yeah.
I want everyone listening to just shake your head, stretch your neck for a second. Let's do a pattern interrupt.
Let's reset.
We've been talking about the math, the offsetting, the smooth exits. But let's imagine what happens when speculator Sally gets completely distracted.
Oh.
Let's say she goes on a silent meditation retreat in Costa Rica. They take her phone. She loses all cell service.
She's totally off the grid.
Right. And she completely forgets to offset her long week contract. The days tick by. What happens when the clock simply runs out? Because this isn't just paper money anymore. The real world is about to crash into her brokerage account.
It gets intensely real, and this brings us into a completely different psychological environment. When open interest doesn't go to zero, when traders fail to offset in time, we enter what is called the spot month.
The spot month. What exactly is the technical definition here?
The spot month, which is also commonly referred to as the front month or the current delivery month, is the specific futures contract that is closest to expiration right now.
Okay.
It is the month that is currently maturing, which means it is the month that is now officially eligible for physical delivery.
Okay, so if it's currently mid-November, the December week contract is considered the spot month.
Correct.
And the deferred months, the ones further out on the calendar, would be March, May, July, and so on.
Exactly. And the moment a contract enters its spot month, the entire psychology and liquidity profile of the market violently shifts. The players change.
How so?
Think about what happens when a fire alarm goes off in a crowded theater. Everyone drops what they are doing and rushes for the exits. That is exactly what speculators do when the spot month arrives.
So speculator Sally, assuming she isn't stuck without wifey in Costa Rica, sees the spot month approaching and she sprints for the exit.
She aggressively offsets her position because she knows physical delivery is no longer a theoretical concept. It is a live, imminent threat.
She wants absolutely no part of the physical grain market.
Yeah.
So you have this mass exodus of all the speculators.
Mm-hmm.
Who was left behind in the theater?
The commercials, the bona fide hedgers, mm-hmm. the people whose actual real world businesses deal in the physical goods.
So Farmer Fred sticks around because he has a silo full of real wheat that he actually needs to deliver to make a living.
Right. And let's say commercial Carl, who owns a massive industrial bakery, sticks around because he actually wants to take delivery of that physical wheat to grind into flour and make bread.
So the entire ecosystem shifts from financial speculators to physical operators. How does that affect the actual trading environment on the screens?
It dramatically drains the liquidity. Liquidity thins out almost instantly. Because there are suddenly far fewer players willing to trade back and forth, the bid-ask spreads widen significantly.
Let's put math to that. Normally, in a highly liquid deferred month, The difference between the highest price a buyer is willing to pay and the lowest price a seller is willing to accept might be just one single tick.
Right.
But in the spot month.
In the spot month, because nobody wants to step in and take the other side of a trade, that spread might gap out to 5 or 10 ticks.
Wow.
A wide bid-ask spread means it's incredibly expensive to get in and out of trades. It becomes much harder to fill large orders without causing the price to slip heavily against you.
So the spot month is a much, much less hospitable environment for a day trader.
Absolutely. And because of that volatile, thin environment, we hit a massive concept that is heavily tested on the Series 3. It's about position limits.
Right. Position limits. Let's get into it.
Position limits are strict regulatory caps set by the exchange and the CFTC. They dictate the absolute maximum number of net contracts a single speculator is legally allowed to hold at any given time.
Okay, so it's a cap.
And the vital rule you must memorize is this. Speculative position limits get tighter, meaning they get numerically smaller in the spot month.
They get tighter. Now, why is this an exam trap? Because human intuition sometimes says the opposite, right?
Definitely. A test taker might think, oh, it's the delivery month, it's the big finale, the volume is peaking, so the limits probably expand to allow for more trading.
But no, they clamp down like a vice. But I don't want to just memorize that. I want to understand the WHY. Why do regulators tighten the leash right at the end?
To understand the why, you have to understand the concept of deliverable supply.
Deliverable supply.
Think about it. Out of all the wheat grown in the entire world, only a very specific tiny fraction of it meets the exchange's strict quality grades, like, you know, number 2 soft red winter wheat.
Right.
And only a fraction of that graded wheat is currently sitting in exchange approved, certified warehouses in Chicago, inspected and ready for formal delivery.
So the deliverable supply is a finite, limited, tangible amount of physical stuff.
It's a bottleneck.
A massive bottleneck.
Exactly. Now, imagine a hypothetical scenario. Imagine a massive billionaire hedge fund manager realizes that there are only enough physical bushels in those approved warehouses to satisfy, say, 10,000 futures contracts.
Okay.
What if he aggressively buys up 15,000 long contracts right before delivery and stubbornly refuses to offset?
Oh, wow. So when Farmer Fred and all the other shorts go looking for the physical wheat to fulfill their delivery obligations, it literally doesn't exist.
It doesn't exist. And because the shorts are legally obligated to deliver but physically cannot find the grain, they are trapped.
So what do?
They are forced to go back to the futures market and frantically buy back their short contracts to offset. But who holds all the long contracts?
The billionaire.
Right. So the shorts are forced to buy them back at whatever astronomical, extortionate price the billionaire demands.
That is the definition of cornering the market. It's a textbook short squeeze.
Exactly. It is highly illegal. It radically distorts prices away from their true economic value, and it completely destroys the integrity of the market.
Because commercials wouldn't be able to hedge effectively if billionaires could just squeeze them at expiration.
Right. So to prevent this, the regulators step in. The exchange strictly caps the number of contracts any one speculator can hold during the spot month, and they peg that limit very closely to their calculation of the actual estimated deliverable supply.
So if they estimate there is only enough physical wheat to fulfill 10,000 contracts, they are going to set the spot month speculative limit at, say, 1,000 contracts per person.
Exactly. They make it mathematically impossible for one rogue actor to demand more physical commodity than actually exists.
That is so smart. Mm-hmm. Regulators are basically testing if you understand market integrity. So if an exam question asks if limits expand or loosen or are waived near expiration,
you cross that answer out immediately. They tighten.
Got it. All right. So we've explored the psychology of the spot month. Let's get down to the actual timeline. There is a specific day on the calendar that strikes fear into the hearts of speculators. First notice day. Or FND. What is the technical mechanism here?
First notice day is the very first day on the calendar on which the short farmer Fred can issue a formal legal notice of intent to deliver the actual physical commodity.
It is the starting gun for the delivery process.
It really is.
And this brings us all the way back to the fundamental thesis we established in the intro. Direction dictates your fate. The short runs the show.
The short is in total unilateral control of the initiation process. Farmer Fred decides whether to deliver at all.
Right.
And within the strict boundaries of the exchange's contract rules, Fred picks the exact timing of the delivery. He picks the specific deliverable grade of the commodity if the contract allows variations, and he picks the approved location or warehouse from which it will be delivered.
You know, it seems slightly unbalanced. Why does the seller get all this discretionary power?
Because the seller is the one who actually has to do the heavy lifting in the physical world. He has the physical goods, he has to arrange the trucks, deal with the warehouse managers, secure the insurance, and ensure the grain passes the exchange's strict quality inspections.
Whereas Speculator Sally just, you know, tapped a piece of glass on her iPhone.
Exactly. So the exchange logically dictates, Fred, you are taking on the actual logistical burden of providing the physical commodity, so you get to dictate the terms, as long as they fit within our pre-approved guidelines.
So the buyer is just along for the ride. The buyer takes what the seller tenders when the seller decides to tender it.
Right. So regulators will absolutely try to trick you here. If you see an exam question saying, the long declares their intent to take delivery, or the buyer chooses the warehouse location to minimize their freight costs.
It is entirely backwards. The short initiates, the long receives. Never forget the direction of power.
Never.
Okay, so if Farmer Fred has all this power and first notice day is the day he can start deploying it, what is the survival rule for Speculator Sally?
Assuming she got her phone back from the yoga instructor.
Exactly. Assuming she has her phone. If she absolutely does not want a truckload of grain, when is her final non-negotiable deadline to get the heck out of her long position?
The survival rule is a simple alliterative memory aid. Flat before first. F.
Flat before first.
She must be flat, which is industry jargon, meaning she has completely offset her position down to zero contracts before first notice day.
Let me clarify that. Flat before first.
Yeah.
Not on first notice day. Before the market opens on that day.
Emphatically, yes. Before.
What happens if she waits?
If she waits until the morning of first notice day to try and sell, she is playing Russian roulette with a fully loaded cylinder.
Why?
Because on that morning, Farmer Fred might have already submitted his notice of intent to deliver to the exchange. And by the time Sally's app loads and she tries to hit sell, she might literally get a notification saying, trade rejected, you have already been assigned delivery, congratulations, your wheat is currently being loaded onto a train.
That is legitimately terrifying. She must be out before the first F.
Do not mess with first notice day.
Okay, so let's look at how this transaction actually happens. We know Shred wants to deliver. We know Sally might accidentally get stuck taking it. But how do they actually interact? Does Fred call Sally? Do they email over a contract? How do they arrange the payment?
Trick question. They never speak. They never interact. They don't even know each other's names.
Okay.
In fact, legally, they have absolutely no relationship with each other whatsoever. This is where the true systemic magic of the futures market happens.
Enter.
The clearinghouse.
Enter the clearinghouse.
The unsung hero of the entire global financial system. Let's demystify what this entity actually does.
The clearinghouse is the ultimate middleman. It operates on a foundational legal mechanism called novation.
Novation. That's a vocabulary word you must deeply understand for the exam.
Novation is the legal and financial process where the clearinghouse steps squarely in between the two original traders and completely breaks their connection.
I want to use an analogy here to make this concrete. Think about buying a house. Normally, the buyer gives money to the seller, and the seller gives the deed to the buyer. Right, direct transfer.
But imagine if, the second you agreed on a price, a massive bank stepped in and said, actually, the buyer is going to pay me, and I will pay the seller, and the seller will give the deed to me, and I will give it to the buyer.
That is very close to what happens. When Fred clicks sell and Sally clicks buy, they are initially executing the trade based on each other's orders in the matching engine.
Right.
But the literal millisecond that trade is matched, novation occurs. The clearinghouse severs the direct contractual link between them.
So they are no longer legally connected.
Exactly. The clearinghouse officially, legally, becomes the buyer to every single seller and the seller to every single buyer.
So it's essentially an impenetrable firewall between the two parties.
Yes. From the moment of novation onward, Farmer Fred does not owe wheat to Sally. Farmer Fred owes wheat to the clearinghouse. And Sally does not owe money to Fred. Sally owes money to the clearinghouse.
But why go through this elaborate legal fiction? Why not just let them deal with each other directly like adults?
Because of counterparty credit risk?
Okay, expand on that.
Think about the reality of trading. Fred doesn't know Sally from a hole in the wall. For all he knows, she's trading on a maxed out credit card, she has terrible judgment, and she is about to declare personal bankruptcy.
Which would be bad if she owed him money.
Very bad. If wheat prices crash and she owes him $100,000 in margin, How does he know she can actually pay?
He doesn't.
And Sally doesn't know Fred. What if his crop was wiped out by a drought and he is totally insolvent? If they had to rely on each other's personal creditworthiness, they would spend all their time running background checks and hiring private investigators instead of trading.
It would completely freeze the entire market. Nobody would trust anybody enough to do volume.
Right. So the brilliance of novation is that they don't have to trust each other. They only have to trust the clearinghouse.
And the clearinghouse is trustworthy.
The clearinghouse is a massively capitalized institution with layers and layers of financial safeguards. They collect initial margin from everyone. They collect variation margin daily based on price moves.
And if someone goes bust.
If a member goes bust, the clearinghouse has a massive mutualized guarantee fund to draw from. It absorbs all the counterparty risk. The traders never have to size each other up.
Okay, this brings us to a massively important trap that the exam sets regarding the clearinghouse. The exam tests the absolute limits of the clearinghouse guarantee.
Yes, this is a big one.
We need to strictly separate two concepts, financial guarantees versus physical guarantees.
This distinction is crucial. The clearinghouse guarantees the financial performance of the contract. It guarantees the money.
What does that mean in a real-world scenario?
It means if Farmer Fred's silo gets struck by lightning and burns to the ground, or if he just stubbornly refuses to deliver the wheat and defaults on his legal obligation, the clearinghouse steps in to protect Sally.
Because she's novated to the clearinghouse.
Exactly. Because she is novated to the clearinghouse, she doesn't lose her money just because Fred defaulted. But here is the critical limitation. The clearinghouse does not guarantee physical delivery.
I use an absurd mental image to remember this, because it highlights how ridiculous the alternative is.
Let's hear it.
If Fred defaults, the high-powered executives at the clearinghouse in downtown Chicago are not going to take off their Italian suits, put on denim overalls, grab iron scythes, drive out to a random field in Kansas, personally harvest a new crop of wheat, load it onto a freight train, and deliver it to Sally.
They absolutely will not. Guaranteeing payment and guaranteeing the physical act of delivery are two entirely different things.
Right. They're a bank, basically.
The clearinghouse does not own tractors. They do not source physical commodities on the open market. They are a financial institution, not an agricultural conglomerate.
So if Fred fails to deliver, what actually happens to Sally? How is she made whole?
The clearinghouse calculates the exact financial damages of Fred's failure based on the current market price of the commodity. They fine Fred, they seize his margin, and they cut Sally a check to make her completely financially whole.
They settle the physical failure in cash. Regulators will test this explicitly. If an exam question says, in the event of a short default, the clearinghouse guarantees the physical delivery of the commodity to the long, you need to recognize that as a trap immediately. Cross it out. They guarantee the money, not the physical act.
Spot on. Now, let's get back to the normal delivery process, the 99% of the time where nobody defaults. First notice day arrives. Farmer Fred has his wheat ready. He issues his formal delivery notice to the clearinghouse.
He says, I am officially ready to deliver against my short position.
Right. Now, the clearinghouse has this notice in their hands. They have to assign it to one of the longs. But there are thousands of longs in the market. How did they pick who gets it? Is it a lottery? Do they draw account numbers from a hat?
It's not random. There's a very specific, strict rule.
The rule is that the notice is assigned to the oldest, longest-held long position on the books.
The oldest long. Why do they do it that way?
It's a queue system. First in, first out. It is the most objective, mechanically fair way to handle assignment.
Okay, visualize that for me.
Imagine all the longs standing in a single file line, sorted by the exact microsecond timestamp of when they bought their contract. The person who has been stubbornly holding their position the longest is standing at the very front of the line. When Fred tosses his delivery notice to the clearinghouse just hands it to whoever is standing first in line.
That makes perfect sense. It forces the people who have been sitting in the trade the longest to deal with the consequences of not offsetting.
Exactly.
But I have a mechanical pushback here, tying back to novation. If novation means the clearinghouse is the legal buyer to every seller, does that mean the clearinghouse physically buys the wheat from Fred, takes ownership of it, puts it in a giant secret clearinghouse vault, and then later hands it over to the oldest long?
Emphatically, no. This is another nuanced trap. The clearinghouse acts as the matchmaker, the administrative hub. They match the delivering short to the oldest long. They assign the paperwork.
Buy it.
But the clearinghouse never, ever takes title to the physical goods themselves.
They never take title. They never own the wheat.
Never. Legal title to the physical commodity passes directly from the short farmer Fred to the assigned long speculator Sally.
So what is a clearinghouse doing during that transfer?
The clearinghouse facilitates the transfer of the funds, and they process the assignment of the notice, but they do not buy, hold, or warehouse the goods.
So the actual chain of title skips over the clearinghouse entirely. It jumps from Fred straight to Sally. That is a vital regulatory nuance.
It is. And understanding that paperwork flow leads us directly into exploring the documents themselves, we need to talk about the paper trail.
Right. So the clearinghouse has tapped the oldest long on the shoulder. They hand them this piece of paper, the delivery notice. What exactly is this document doing?
A delivery notice, officially called a notice of intention to deliver, is the formal trigger mechanism. It is the document that converts a short, abstract, theoretical paper obligation into a concrete, real-world reality.
And it flows in a specific direction.
Yes, it flows in a very specific directional path. From the short, to the clearinghouse, to the assigned long. Until this specific notice is issued, nothing physical has to move.
But the crucial twist that the exam will definitely test you on is that not all delivery notices are created equal.
Oh, absolutely not.
There are two types, and the type you receive dictates your fate. Let's do a side-by-side comparison of transferable versus non-transferable notices.
Let's start with the transferable notice. I call this the flaming hot potato.
I love that. Why is it a hot potato?
Because if speculator Sally, who happens to be our oldest long, gets assigned a transferable notice, she has a tiny, fleeting window of salvation. She does not necessarily have to take the wheat.
She can save herself.
She can save herself by tossing the hot potato to someone else.
How exactly does she toss it?
By executing a highly specific process called retendering.
Retendering. Okay, let's define that carefully, because this is heavy exam vocabulary.
Retendering means that Sally goes back into the live futures market and rapidly sells an offsetting futures contract.
Okay, so she sells, then what?
By executing that sell order, she essentially steps out of the front of the line and she hands the delivery obligation down to the next oldest long behind her. The potato keeps moving until it finally lands in the lap of someone who actually wants the physical commodity and is willing to hold the notice.
But this isn't a leisurely process, right? She can't just sleep on it.
Not at all. The exchanges grant you a very brief, strictly enforced window to retender. We are talking hours, sometimes less, depending on the specific exchange rules. You have to make the decision fast, and you have to execute the trade fast.
And here is the exact trap regulators will set on retendering.
What's the trap?
The exam might ask, if a long receives a transferable notice and does not wish to take delivery, they should simply refuse the notice, sign a waiver, and return it to the clearinghouse.
Wrong. You cannot just say, no thanks, return to sender. The clearinghouse doesn't care if you don't want it. You are legally obligated by that notice the moment it hits your account. The only way out is to execute a new, actual offsetting futures trade on the open market.
You have to actively sell a contract to pass the legal obligation. It requires market action, not just administrative refusal.
Yes, exactly. Okay, so that's the transferable notice, the hot potato.
Now, what about the non-transferable notice?
The non-transferable notice is what I call super glue.
Super glue. Because it sticks to you permanently.
Exactly. If Sally gets handed a non-transferable notice, game over. She is completely locked in. She cannot retender. She cannot jump back into the market and sell a new contract to pass it on.
So she's stuck.
The delivery obligation is glued to her hand, and she must accept delivery of the physical commodity and pay the full invoice amount to Farmer Fred.
So the type of notice makes all the difference in the world.
It does, and you don't get to choose. The contract specifications for each individual commodity dictate whether its notices are transferable or non-transferable. You have to know what game you are playing before you enter the spot month.
All right, listener, I have another direct question for you. Think fast.
Here we go.
You are holding a long position in soybean futures. You messed up, you lost track of the calendar, and you didn't get flat before first notice day.
Bad move.
The clearinghouse assigns you a transferable delivery notice. You live in a studio apartment. You have zero desire to take this commodity. What is the specific vocabulary word for what you are about to do, and what is the exact mechanical action you take to do it?
Think about the hot potato.
The word is retender.
Mm-hmm.
And the specific action you take is to rapidly sell an offsetting futures contract within the exchange's short time window.
Nailed it. Now let's explore the end game. Let's imagine the absolute worst-case scenario for speculator Sally.
Okay, let's say she was handed a non-transferable notice, the super glue.
She is completely stuck. She has to take delivery.
What actually happens next? Does a fleet of 18-wheeler trucks pull up to her apartment building and start blowing wheat through her fifth-floor window?
Thankfully, no. The futures market is far more civilized and far more paper-based than that. Raw commodities are never wheeled across the trading floor, and they are certainly not delivered to residential addresses.
So how does it arrive?
Physical delivery happens via a document of title.
A document of title. So she just gets a piece of paper. That sounds anticlimactic.
She gets a piece of paper, or more likely today, a secure electronic entitlement that legally proves she is the absolute owner of a specific pile of wheat sitting somewhere else.
Okay, got it.
There are two main types of these documents that you absolutely need to know for the exam. The warehouse receipt and the shipping certificate.
Let's break those down. What is the mechanism of a warehouse receipt?
A warehouse receipt is exactly what it sounds like. It is a legally binding document issued by an exchange-approved, regularly inspected warehouse. It is concrete evidence of title.
What does it actually say?
It says, the bearer of this specific receipt is the absolute legal owner of 5,000 bushels of number 2 soft red winter wheat, currently sitting in silo number 4 at this specific facility located in Chicago, Illinois.
So Sally doesn't have the wheat in her apartment. But she legally owns the wheat in that specific silo.
Right.
She can leave it there and pay monthly storage fees to the warehouse. She can sell the receipt to a bakery like Commercial Carl. Or if she really wanted to, she could hire a logistics company to go pick it up.
Precisely. It is a bearer instrument representing tangible property. Now, the second type is a shipping certificate. This operates slightly differently.
How so?
A warehouse receipt says the grain is sitting right there in a specific dedicated bin with your name on it. A shipping certificate is a legally binding commitment by an approved facility to deliver the commodity to the holder on demand.
So they might not have it in a specific dedicated bin waiting for you right that second.
Right, but they guarantee they have the operational capacity to load it onto a train or a barge whenever you present the certificate and ask for it.
When would they use that instead of a warehouse receipt?
It's often used for commodities or facilities where a static warehouse receipt doesn't operationally make sense because the inventory is constantly moving, but the end result is the same. The long receives a document representing the physical goods, not the goods themselves, in their living room.
Okay, that covers physical commodities like grains, metals, and energy. But let's look at the other side of the coin. What about financial futures? Because this brings up a massive conceptual shift that the regulators will test heavily.
It does. We need to pivot and talk about cash settlement. This is the domain of the imaginary goods.
Imaginary goods. I mean, think about it logistically. You can't park the S&P 500 in a warehouse.
No, you can't.
You can't put a secured overnight financing rate, SOFR, into a silo. You can't issue a warehouse receipt for an interest rate. It's impossible.
Exactly. When financial futures were invented in the 1970s and 80s, the exchanges ran into a brick wall. How do you physically deliver a broad stock index?
Do you force the short to go into the market, buy exactly 500 different stocks in mathematically exact proportions, and hand over thousands of physical stock certificates to the long?
It would be an administrative nightmare. The transaction costs would completely destroy the value of the hedge. So the industry invented a completely new mechanism, cash settlement.
Walk me through exactly how the math of cash settlement works. Let's use the S&P 500 futures as our example.
With a cash settled contract, no physical commodity ever moves. There is no delivery instrument. There is no warehouse receipt.
No.
When the contract reaches expiration, the exchange just looks at the final official cash price of the underlying index or rate. That becomes the final settlement price. Then they simply look at everyone's accounts and run the math.
Let's do the math. Let's say Sally bought one S&P 500 contract at a price of $5,000. It expires, and the final official settlement price of the index is $5,050.
Okay, so Sally is long, and the market went up. She won. The index moved 50 points in her favor. The multiplier for the standard S&P 500 contract is $50 per point. So 50 points multiplied by $50 per point equals $2,500.
And how does she get that money?
The clearinghouse simply deposits $2,500 in cash directly into Sally's brokerage account. And simultaneously, they deduct $2,500 from the account of whoever was short. The contract ceases to exist. It just settles up the difference in cash. It is pure financial mathematics.
It's brilliantly efficient. No stock certificates, no warehouses, just a final mark-to-market cash transfer. And this leads to a very common exam trap. The exam writers will mix and match vocabulary from physical delivery and cash settlement to see if you're truly paying attention.
Yes. They will give you a scenario like, upon expiration of a Eurodollar or an S&P 500 futures contract, The short must deliver a warehouse receipt or shipping certificate to the assigned long.
And you must immediately recognize how absurd that sentence is. You cannot have a warehouse receipt for an abstract mathematical index. Cash-settled contracts have no delivery instruments whatsoever. If a question pairs a financial future with a physical delivery document, it is a trap.
Keep the physical world and the math world strictly separated in your mind.
Perfect. All right, we are rounding the corner into our final major regulatory topic. Everything we've talked about so far, the matching engine, the open interest, the novation, the retendering, all of this relies on the fundamental premise that trades happen openly and competitively on the exchange's central order book.
Every bid and offer is public.
But is there ever a time when you can just bypass the whole public system and do a backdoor deal?
The short answer is almost never. The golden regulatory rule of futures markets is that all trades must be executed openly and competitively on the central market. It prevents manipulation. But there is one major, heavily tested, highly specific exception. It is called an exchange for physicals, or EFP.
An EFP. Exchange for physicals.
Yeah.
You also sometimes hear it called XPIT, or against actuals. What exactly is this loophole, and why does it exist?
An EFP is a privately negotiated, completely off-exchange transaction. Two parties get together, away from the electronic order book, maybe over the phone or in a private corporate office, and they agree to simultaneously swap a futures position for the exact matching cash or physical position on opposite sides of the market.
Okay, that definition is dense. Let's use our characters to visualize why anyone would actually need to do this in the real world. We need Farmer Fred, and we need to bring back Commercial Carl, the guy who runs the massive industrial bakery.
Perfect. Let's set the stage. Commercial Carl needs actual physical wheat right now to bake his bread. He doesn't want to wait for the whole convoluted exchange delivery process. He just wants to buy wheat directly from a reliable farmer.
Right. And Farmer Fred has the physical wheat in his silo, and he is willing to sell it to Carl.
So they can just sign a contract and do a cash deal for the physical wheat. That's easy. But what does the futures market have to do with it?
Yeah, why involve the futures market at all?
Because both of them are sophisticated commercial hedgers. Months ago, Farmer Fred sold short futures contracts to protect against prices dropping before harvest. And Commercial Carl bought long futures contracts to protect against prices rising before he needed to buy.
So right now, today, they both have open futures positions on the exchange that they desperately need to close out.
Ah, so Carl wants to buy the physical wheat A&D. He wants to exit his long futures position. Fred wants to sell the physical wheat A&D. He wants to exit his short futures position. They have perfectly mirroring needs.
Exactly. Normally, if they did this separately, they would face massive leg risk.
Leg risk. Explain that.
Let's say Fred sells the physical wheat to Carl at whatever today's cash price is. That's leg one. Now, Fred has to go onto the open exchange and furiously try to buy back his short futures contracts. And Carl has to go to the exchange and try to sell his long futures contracts.
Right.
That's leg two. While they are trying to execute leg two, they're completely exposed to live market fluctuations. Imagine a major newswire hits, say a massive drought in Russia, while they're typing in their orders. The price of wheat futures violently gaps up 50 cents in 3 seconds.
So Fred loses a fortune trying to buy back his shorts, and Carl's hedge is totally disconnected from the price he paid for the physical wheat. They suffer massive slippage.
Right. They lose millions to slippage because the two legs of their strategy were executed at different times in different markets. It is incredibly stressful and financially dangerous for people who just want to bake bread and farm. So an EFP solves this entirely.
How does an EFP bypass the leg risk?
An EFP allows them to skip the open market completely. Fred and Carl shake hands in a back room. They agree on one single unified price for the entire package. Simultaneously, Fred hands the physical wheat to Carl, and Carl hands his long futures position over to Fred, effectively canceling out Fred's short position.
Oh.
They swap the physical and the paper in one clean bilateral move. No market risk, no slippage, no chasing prices on a flashing screen.
It's an elegant, necessary solution for commercial hedgers. But this is where the exam will try to nail you. The trap here is the illegal trade trick.
Yes. Regulators know this sounds suspicious to an outsider. The exam will give you a scenario describing an EFP, a privately negotiated off-market swap, and ask you to categorize it legally. One of the answers will inevitably be, this is an illegal, prohibited off-exchange trade.
I mean, it does sound shady. Two guys in a back room bypassing the central public order book. It sounds like a severe violation of transparency rules.
But it is not. The EFP is a permitted legal exception. It is heavily regulated and recognized by the CFTC as a vital hedging tool for commercials. You must mark it as a legitimate exception to the open outcry rule.
But there is a massive regulatory catch, right? It's not a total secret.
Exactly. Just because you negotiated it privately does not mean you can keep it hidden from the regulators. The catch is that an EFP must be reported to the exchange immediately after it is consummated.
Why does it have to be reported if it was a private deal?
For two critical reasons. First, for clearing. The clearinghouse still needs to process the transfer of the futures contracts between Fred and Carl's accounts to keep the open interest metrics perfectly accurate. If they don't report it, the clearinghouse thinks they both still have open risk.
And the second reason.
Second, for market surveillance. The CFTC needs to see these trades to ensure nobody is using EFPs as a loophole to manipulate prices, hide losses, or launder money. It is an off-exchange negotiation, but it is an on-the-record trade.
Off-exchange negotiation, on-the-record trade. That is the perfect way to summarize an EFP.
All right, we have covered an immense amount of ground today. We've gone from the exit doors of offsetting to the math of open interest through the psychological terror of the spot month, past the clearinghouse firewall, and finally to the delivery docks.
We covered it all.
Let's lock this in with a rapid-fire recap of the absolute top testable takeaways from this unit. Let's hit them fast.
I'm ready. Number one, direction. To offset, you must reverse your entry. Longs offset by selling, shorts offset by buying back. Never double your position by mistake.
Number two, open interest. It only falls if both sides of the transaction are actively closing an existing position. A transfer to a new trader leaves open interest completely unchanged.
Number three, power dynamics. The short controls the physical delivery process. The short dictates whether to deliver and picks the timing, grade, and location within the contract parameters.
Number four, survival. If you are a speculator who doesn't want the commodity, you must get flat before first notice day. FS, do not wait for the morning of.
Number five, the spot month. Because physical deliverable supply is limited, speculative position limits get tighter, meaning strictly numerically smaller, as expiration approaches, to prevent short squeezes.
Number six, the clearinghouse. Through novation, the clearinghouse guarantees the financial performance of the contract, not the physical delivery of the actual commodity. They will pay you cash, but they won't harvest the wheat.
Number seven, assignment. When a delivery notice is issued, it is assigned to the oldest, longest held long position in the queue.
Number eight, notices. Only a transferable notice can be passed along. You do this by retendering, which requires actively selling a new offsetting futures contract on the market, not just refusing the paperwork.
Number nine, settlement types. Cash-settled contracts like stock, index futures, or interest rates involve no physical delivery, which means they never utilize warehouse receipts or shipping certificates. It's just a cash mark to market.
And finally, number 10, EFPs. An exchange for physicals is a privately negotiated swap of futures for cash positions. It eliminates leg risk for commercials. It is a legally permitted exception to open outcry, but it absolutely must be reported to the exchange immediately.
Excellent recap. If a listener can internalize those 10 points and truly understand the why behind them, they're going to utterly crush this section of the Series 3.
I couldn't agree more. Before we let you go, though, we like to end every deep dive with a final provocative thought. Mm-hmm. Something that pushes beyond the textbook and gets into the philosophical reality of the markets. What do you have for us today?
I want you to think deeply about the sheer, mind-boggling logistical miracle of novation. We just spent all this time talking about how the clearinghouse is the ultimate middleman. It absorbs the counterparty risk of Farmer Fred and Speculator Sally. It stands squarely in the middle of every single trade.
Right.
But extrapolate that out to the macro level. The entire global derivatives market, we are talking hundreds of trillions of dollars in notional value, rests entirely on the unshakable premise that the clearinghouse will never, ever go bankrupt.
It's the keystone holding up the entire global financial arch.
Exactly. But what happens if a once-in-a-century market shock, a global black swan event, causes so many massive, highly leveraged institutional traders to default all at the exact same time that the mutualized guarantee fund is drained? What if the shock actually breaks the clearinghouse itself? If the entity that guarantees everything fails, who bails out the ultimate middleman? It's a terrifying question, and one that regulators lose sleep over, especially after 2008. keep that fragility in mind as you study the financial safeguards, margin requirements, and position limits of these exchanges. Every rule we discussed today exists to prevent that exact nightmare scenario.
That is a chilling thought to end on. But it makes you appreciate the incredible gravity of what you're studying. The rules aren't just bureaucracy designed by regulators to torture test takers. They are the structural guardrails keeping the global economy from driving off a cliff. Think back to our opening. The X-ray machine might be broken, and the diagnostic landscape of futures delivery might be muddy, but now you have the map. You know how to read the signals, you know how to avoid the 5,000 bushels of wheat in your lobby, and you are completely ready to conquer this exam. See you on the next deep dive.